The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, April 19th, 2019. You can't guess why we're here. It's just one of these mysteries. No, I'm joking. The Mueller report, as you know, dropped yesterday. We have only had it for 24 hours. We've all spent a lot of quality time with it. We're going to spend a lot more quality time with it over the next days, weeks, and months. But we are ready to have an initial conversation about it. In the Jungle Studio, I am here with Mary McCord of Georgetown Law and formerly acting head of the National Security Division at Justice, Susan Hennessy, who needs no introduction to Lawfare listeners. Joining us by phone, former White House counsel Bob Bauer, and from Costa Rica, Paul Rosenzweig, and a special guest, New York Times reporter Charlie Savage, who happens to be in Costa Rica with Paul Rosenzweig reading the Mueller report. Welcome, everybody. All right, we've got a huge amount of material to cover, so let's just get started. Susan, what is, you know, for you, the Mueller report in one short takeaway paragraph?
For me, in one short takeaway paragraph, it is no conspiracy, lots of collusion. And it is obstruction of justice, but the president is not indictable while in office. That's my one sentence version of it. On the collusion conspiracy side in particular, which is getting a little bit less attention, in part because the implications of the obstruction fact pattern and analysis, I think, are so immense and so consequential. But, you know, just to sort of pause a minute on what this report says about what occurred in the 2016 election, which is not just establishing the conspiracy on the Russian side to interfere with the election in order to help Trump, but pervasive knowledge and awareness of those efforts by Trump and individuals associated with his campaign, that they welcomed those efforts, that they not only failed to warn the American people, but actually developed a campaign and messaging strategy that sought to capitalize on those illicit efforts, and that every element of sharing a common purpose and working towards that purpose, and that purpose being a profoundly wrong one, was there. The only element that was missing was the technical meeting of the minds, the actual agreement necessary for conspiracy. And so the lack of that element, which of course is significant whenever you're thinking about criminal charging decisions, I actually think masks a lot of the profoundly disturbing underlying conduct.
All right. So my next question is, to anybody who disagrees in any significant or fundamental way with Susan's top line, one brief paragraph account of the Mueller report, does that sound like a plausible one to you all, or would somebody offer a different one in its place?
So I don't disagree that there's a significant amount of profoundly disturbing information in part one of the report. I guess I think it from a criminal law perspective, having spent most of my career as a criminal prosecutor, the absence of that agreement really is the sine qua non of conspiracy. And so it's clear no one could come away from reading this report without feeling like members of the Trump campaign and Trump himself encouraged, welcomed, were very interested in, delighted in almost the Russian election interference efforts, but never were able to make, you know, connect the dots between we really like what you're doing and want it to happen and the Russians who were actually engaged in it. And so what I think is important for readers and for the American voters to pay attention to is, you know, not only the vulnerability of our election systems and the fact that Russia's going to keep on doing what it did in the past, and we all need to be smarter about where we get our information, and our private sector needs to be smarter about the way, you know, internet service platforms and social media is used and all of that, but also that you know, how do people feel about a campaign and a president who so welcomed efforts by a foreign adversary, formidable foreign adversary, to affect the results of the election?
May I raise the flag here briefly on the campaign finance issue? I thought that Mueller disposed of that incorrectly. I understand the analysis. I understand why he came to the conclusion that he did. But I don't think that it is an entirely satisfactory analysis. And it's one of the points in the report where, for example, in citing constitutional constraints, the Trump campaign and the persons involved in welcoming emissaries from Moscow promising dirt on Hillary Clinton got more than their share of the benefit of the legal and constitutional doubt.
Okay, so back up, Bob, and walk us through what the other Bob concluded there and why you think there is a defect in the campaign finance analysis.
The statute in question is unambiguous. It is broad. Congress amended it several times, most recently in 2003 to tighten it. And it prohibits soliciting or accepting any support whatsoever in cash or in kind from a foreign national. End of story. So it's bizarre that there was some question about whether this was some, you know, piece of the law that the participants in this meeting somehow didn't understand. They didn't recognize that it was a campaign finance issue. That analysis was even extended to Paul Manafort, who's been around presidential campaigns for decades. It struck me as surpassingly odd. And then there was a series of analytic points about whether you really can value the information they were offering, whether certain financial thresholds in the statutes had been exceeded, that I think are open to very reasonable dispute. And then last but not least, there was some question about, you know, whether or not a finding here could be sustained in the face of constitutional objections. And I think of all of the areas in which the constitutional objections wind up being, shall we say, less powerful, this area, foreign national support, is certainly one of them. So it was, to me, a somewhat frustrating analysis. I don't question that it's an alternative reading of the law, but it is yet another way in which the constitutional doubts at every stage were resolved in Donald Trump and his campaign's favor. And I should mention one other point, which is, had they not wished to indict on the campaign finance charges the individual participants and the senior staff in that meeting, the campaign itself could have been indicted. And that was a route that apparently the special counsel didn't consider. I mean, and that would not, by the way, run up against the OLC opinions in any way, immunizing the president from illegal exposure.
Paul, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm always reluctant to disagree even in the least bit with Susan and Mary, but I think that they understate the degree to which an agreement between the Trump campaign and the Russian intelligence services has already been proven. Agreements don't need to be explicitly proven. They can be inferred from patterns of conduct, And they don't need to be covert. They can be as overt as one person saying, hey, Ben, I'd really like it if you gave me some email, and then Ben giving me an email. That would be a circumstance from which we could infer that there was, in fact, a meeting of minds between you and I. The way I've phrased it in talking about it to friends is, if this were a white-collar case involving somebody other than the president and we were on the same set of facts, I don't think there'd be any reluctance to have inferred the actual agreement that was more than just kind of conscious parallelism, but an actual meeting of the minds as to an objective to be achieved. And I think that it's highly likely that it, in front of a neutral finder of fact, in a white-collar crime context devoid of politicization, that the prosecution would win that case 8 times out of 10.
So you're just to be clear, you're suggesting that in fact Mueller is understating the availability of evidence of conspiracy, that, and when he says we did not establish it, you're suggesting he's interpreting his evidence extremely conservatively?
Extremely conservatively, requiring explicit direct evidence of an agreement where inferential circumstantial evidence would normally suffice, and consistent with what Bob has just said, kind of institutionalizing his view and breaking the tie in favor of the president when in, you know, to the extent there's a tie, when in most cases the prosecutorial function is to let that decision be made by a grand jury and a jury. I mean, I get why he does that politically, but as a practical matter, in terms of raw compliance or noncompliance with the criminal law, I could make out this case as a conspiracy and charge it, and I think I'd have more than enough to survive, for example, a Rule 29 motion to dismiss.
Mary?
Yeah, so I, you know, putting aside the example Bob gave of the campaign finance violation related to the June meeting at Trump Tower, just going off of Paul's description of it, even if you publicly make a statement, sort of asking for emails to be published, you could infer an agreement there. I think it's also important to keep in mind here something, frankly, that Attorney General Barr said at his press conference, which is that the mere publication of non-classified, non-defense information emails, even if there was an agreement to publish those, you know, may not actually, I mean, the publication itself, of course, is not illegal. Now, you might have a conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government under 371, you know, that more could be probed on. But, you know, I think there's a lot of different aspects of the Russian interference and which part we're talking about there potentially being evidence of agreement in is important, because some would obviously, if there was agreement with respect to somebody in the Trump campaign working with or providing any kind of tools or tricks or tips to anybody in the Russian government to actually engage in the hacking, kind of the way Assange provided or offered or tried to provide password cracking mechanisms to Chelsea Manning in order to access a classified computer system. If there's that kind of agreement, then that's one thing, which is different, I think, from encouraging in a very, very public way, Russia, if you're out there, you know, it'd be great to put out some more emails and find Hillary Clinton's emails.
Especially because the emails that he was talking about in that speech were the supposedly missing 30,000 emails from her private server, not the ones that were stolen from John Podesta or the DNC. So I actually am surprised, Paul, to hear you suggest that the evidence of conspiracy is stronger than Mueller allows, because I'm actually a bit skeptical of that. But I want to bring Charlie in and get a sense, Charlie, of your overall takeaway when you look at the big picture of this report. What do you think the story is?
Well, so far this conversation is focused on Volume 1, the collusion chapter, and not the
obstruction component. I think that we kind of knew going into yesterday that we were looking at a situation in which there was overtly in public view, we all knew about, either it had been reported or it happened in public, that there was a lot of sort of complicit looking conduct. We knew from Barr's maybe problematic summary last month that Mueller had decided it had fallen short of criminal conspiracy with an agreement, explicit or tacit, at least in his view. But the mystery going, and now we have lots more detail, and history will have that to look back at decades from now. To me, the most interesting part, and maybe this can serve as a transition, was the obstruction side answering or solving the mystery that Barr's letter had left open of why Mueller did not perform a prosecutorial determination of whether or not Trump committed a crime of obstruction. And the takeaway being that Mueller was leaving open the possibility that after Trump is no longer the sitting president, future prosecutors could look at the evidence that he had gathered and decide then whether to charge ex-President Trump with a crime. He wanted to leave that open temporarily, and that's what he was up to. And Barr thwarted that by claiming in his letter that Mueller's then inexplicable decision not to make that judgment had left it to him as Attorney General to fill the vacuum and pronounce Trump cleared now, notwithstanding constitutional issues about indicting a sitting president. Now, that was a really extraordinary intervention, and the obstruction section of the report was filled with breadcrumbs toward the conclusion that Trump probably did commit obstruction of justice, and it was just premature to say that out loud. I just found that fascinating.
So before we move on to sort of the obstruction discussion, I do want to make one larger point on sort of the points that Paul and Mary were making, and that's, Paul, I agree that there are clearly parts of there are clearly parts of this in which there is a clear meeting of the minds, just not towards a criminal end. And then there are clear criminal ends in which they both support it, right? So the meeting of the minds not towards a criminal end, the Trump Tower Moscow sort of conversations and discussions, that element clearly exists. It's just, and it's deeply improper. It's just not a crime. Then there's sort of the hacking campaign where clearly the Trump campaign is at least notionally aware of what's going on, but we don't actually see the agreement. The area in which, and actually if you look at page 176 of volume one on the report, almost all of the pages redacted, and this is the discussion related to declinations of why they're not charging. And there's a footnote discussion that's not redacted in footnote 1278 that talks about the office considered but ruled out charges on a theory that post-hacking sharing and dissemination of emails could consider trafficking of stolen property. So I think it's relatively clear that that's a footnote to a discussion about legal theories about whether or not post-hacking dissemination and the clear meeting of the minds the report seems to lay out, whether or not that could provide the basis where you have both the existence of the agreement and also the existence of a criminal charge. And that's one of the most sort of fascinating areas of redaction, where I think that's where Mueller lays out his specific reasoning on not thinking that the agreement and crime elements are met in the same place.
So, Bob, if we're turning to obstruction, I want to come back to a recurrent issue that you have spoken about on this podcast in the past, which is the fascinating character of Don McGahn. And one thing this report does, volume two, that is it gives a just dramatic amount of new information about his behavior as White House counsel. And a lot of it is, frankly, more flattering than a lot of the prior times that we have had occasion to talk about him. So I'm interested for your, as part of our sort of ongoing, former White House counsel scratch his head about Don McGahn series. What's the Don McGahn story in Volume 2 here?
Volume 2 shows that McGahn understood pretty quickly that he was going to be met with presidential demands that were wholly inappropriate or would tend to implicate the president and him, if he acquiesced in them, to legal exposure. There's been a lot of attention to his refusal to execute the order to fire Mueller or to see that DOJ fired Mueller. A little less attention to the president's attempt to have him create a false record in the White House counsel's office files to substantiate the lie that he had not ordered McGahn to fire Mueller. So that's quite remarkable. The White House counsel is asked by the president not merely to lie, but to create a false record in support of the lie. Now, in that, in a number of other instances, McGahn either waits the president out, or in the more dramatic moment related in the report, he threatens to resign. Interestingly, there's no face-to-face conversation between him and the president to resolve that issue. So the relationship is a extraordinary one in the history of White House counsels. If you set aside John Dean for a moment, who wound up testifying, cooperating with law enforcement authorities against President Nixon, this is one for the books.
All right. So one of the things that I was really struck by was the degree to which the president is protected to some degree against criminal exposure by his wild ineffectiveness in managing the executive branch. He orders all these things to happen in a fashion that, had they happened, I don't think anybody would have been doubting today that he had engaged in an obstructive act. But people kind of wait him out, or as you described, just kind of don't respond, just don't do it or refuse. And that's, you know, from the level of the FBI director and the attorney general to the level of pretty, you know, mid-level White House staff, as well as outside advisors like Corey Lewandowski, who just can't kind of be troubled to call the attorney general and put pressure on him to unrecuse. And so, Mary, I'm curious, do you think the ultimate reason that we are not seeing a clear conclusion that the president obstructed justice is that the executive branch is so non-unitary that just as he can't withdraw from a trade agreement because somebody will slip the document off his desk, he can't obstruct justice because no one will carry it out for him?
No, and that's because you can obstruct justice or attempt to obstruct justice. You don't have to succeed in obstructing justice to be chargeable with a criminal offense.
Right. No, so to be clear, I'm not saying that he doesn't meet the statutory elements on this basis. I'm saying it has a completely different tonal inflection because so many of these things don't actually happen, that even Mueller writes in the thing, you know, actually most of these orders weren't carried out. You know, and so the stakes feel way lower than they would if somebody had actually gone ahead and done the thing.
I actually think that Mueller took some real care in his report to reject the notion that the stakes are lower because of that. I mean, there's no question that if he'd really obstructed justice, we might not even be at the point of having this report, because he would have been successful in firing Mueller and maybe no one would have replaced him and we wouldn't be reading this today. So clearly that, you know, from that perspective, the stakes would have been higher. But, you know, on page 158 of volume two, Mueller sets out exactly what you were just talking about, that the president's efforts were mostly unsuccessful, but that is largely because the people who surrounded him declined to carry out his orders. But Mueller goes on to make it clear that the president, particularly after he knew that he himself was personally under investigation as of June 14th, 2017, he engaged in a series of targeted efforts to control the investigation and recounts these, you know, attempting to remove the special counsel, seeking to have AG Sessions unrecuse himself and limit the investigation, seeking to prevent public disclosure of information about the Trump Tower meeting between Russians and campaign officials, and using, you know, every possible public forum to attack potential witnesses who might have adverse against information against him, and certainly then privately doing it as well. So I think that I think by the sheer volume of evidence recounted in, you know, more than well over 150 pages of volume two, I think Mueller's trying to tell us this is what happened. It is important. It is significant. And he was leaving that roadmap we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I also think this report reflects to the degree to which the president was successful. There are important questions that the Mueller team wasn't able to answer, and it's reasonable to attribute their inability to answer those questions to the president's obstructive efforts, right? So whether or not the president was aware of the substance of Michael Flynn's phone call with Sergei Kislyak before or after, right? The Mueller team talks about kind of trying to construct this. Trump tries to tell McFarland, tries to convince her to write a memo saying that she didn't tell him about it. She says she can't do that. They appear to have some sort of conflicting testimony. They say we couldn't establish this. Ditto for whether or not Trump had knowledge about the June 9th Trump Tower meeting. Some testimony on either side. Big sort of redaction for grand jury and ongoing matters material redaction. I think that there is, you know, oh, and additionally, the president never sat down and agreed to an interview and said that he did not recall in more than 30 instances on his written answers and refused to answer any questions related to obstruction of justice. And so there's a lot of places in which the Mueller report is quite explicit that there are persistent questions that they just weren't able to answer. And for a great many of those, the but-for causation or the proximate cause of it is what the president was doing to prevent that answer from coming to light.
That's not unusual, though, in the sense that usually prosecutors don't have the opportunity to target interview the targets or subjects of their investigation. So I totally agree that a lot of that precluded the special counsel from getting answers to certain questions. But prosecutors are used to that sort of inhibition because they they're used to having to build their case of intent based on circumstantial evidence and not have the benefit of an actual interview.
Sure, although they're certainly not used to not having the full cooperation of, say, somebody like Paul Manafort, who's accepted a plea deal because somebody has dangled the possibility of a pardon.
Charlie, when you look at this report, I mean, you've followed the obstruction investigation and allegations as closely as anybody, except perhaps your colleague Mike Schmidt. Did you read this document and say, wow, this record is fundamentally much worse than we had understood? Did you read it and say, this is filling out a whole lot of detail that we already knew, but the essential allegations are largely a matter of putting on the record what had been in a bunch of news stories, particularly in the New York Times, about sourced anonymously. By the way, the New York Times reporting on obstruction looks really, really good after the release of this document. That's an aside. But or did you look at it and say it's kind of somewhere in between? There's, you know, the basic guideposts were already there, but there's sort of more than detail added. There's some things that are qualitatively different. Like, how much did you learn?
That's an interesting way you put the question. I mean, certainly there were a few more episodes that had not existed in the public domain in any form. The Corey Lewandowski one that was mentioned earlier, for example, trying to get him to pressure Sessions to unrecuse. But I think that most of the obstruction stuff, the actual episodes, we did know about. Of course, a lot of that reporting was followed by denunciations from Trump world that it was all fake news, these sources didn't exist, it was all made up. And so it's nice to have it confirmed based on, you know, an investigation armed with subpoenas and grand jury testimony and all the rest, and that it all that stuff actually did happen, and as well as witness interviews where it would be a felony to lie to the special counsel as opposed to lying to the public and reporters. And so on behalf of my colleagues like Mike and Maggie, who are at the core of covering the collusion, the obstruction side of it, I thank you for the compliment of their reporting. Moving out of this, or to reiterate or amplify what I said earlier, I think the most, beyond seeing that is all that stuff was real and really did happen, the takeaway for me was why did Mueller not make a decision, and the obvious implication of his work that he thought that a couple years from now or whenever it is that Trump is no longer president, prosecutors should be in a position to look at this thorough evidence he gathered and then render a decision about whether to indict ex-President Trump, a plan that may have been too clever by half, given that the Attorney General then seized that opening to try to close that door.
Although there's nothing as happened in when the Bush administration went out and the Obama administration came in and Eric Holder ordered a whole bunch of interrogation cases reopened and reexamined. There's nothing that precludes a subsequent administration from reopening that, although it would be unusual and arguably irregular. So, Paul, you have criticized Mueller on this point, and I am inclined to defend him on this point. So let's spar a little bit. Make the case that this was an inappropriate punt on Mueller's part.
Well, I'm not going to make the case that Mueller should have indicted the president. That clearly was precluded by DOJ policy, and he is a creature of the department. And I've said for over a year and a half that he wasn't going to indict the president. But failing to reach a conclusive judgment about whether or not this was a prosecutable case or not, or even worse, failing to even try. If he tried and said the evidence is in equipoise, I wouldn't have a complaint either. But what he did was he explicitly said, I'm not going to answer one of the two most important questions that I've been asked. The first is, were crimes committed in connection with Russia's interference in the election? He answered that one. And we've already talked about why I think he might have answered it wrong, but at least he answered it. And then he simply declined to answer that question with respect to the president, which in effect was a declaration by Mueller that the president can only be exonerated. He can never be condemned, even in instances in which he is deserving of condemnation. And his reasoning was exclusively prudential, right? Once you get past the can't indict, the reason for not drawing a conclusion as to criminality were the prudential ones of, unfairness to the subject. And that's a real concern, but it's much less in the case of a president who, A, has a bully pulpit from which he can answer, and B, whose conduct is a fit and important subject for consideration by the American people, who ought to be on the other side, given the opportunity to make a judgment about Trump and his fitness for office, informed by the expertise of Mueller in answering the very question that he's been asked and which he was tasked with asking. So I think that in protecting the presidency and saying that a president should not be publicly condemned, he advanced the institution of the president at the expense of informing the public about the actions of this particular president. And while that might even have been a sensible judgment in normal cases, Trump is not a normal president.
I'm sorry. So just a quick thought here. I think it's when I said earlier that I think what Mueller did was too clever by half, not just because it left an opening for Barr to intervene in a way that Mueller apparently did not anticipate. The other piece of that in my mind is I don't believe Mueller when he says he didn't perform a traditional prosecutorial analysis, because he also said that if the facts had been clear to exonerate Trump of obstruction, he would have said that. He was willing to say that, and he just couldn't because the facts raised difficult issues that prevented him from saying the president did not commit obstruction. And that means he went through the facts and the law in his head and decided that the president could not be exonerated by the evidence he had gathered. And therefore, when he then says, I didn't do a prosecutorial analysis, he's not really being candid, because what he's saying is, I just don't want to utter the opposite words, which is the president did commit a prosecutable offense, even though I am saying that I know the president did not commit one. That's my point.
Bob, do you think Mueller's just being coy here? And do you think Paul's critique and Charlie's related critique have merit? Or is there more to be said for what Mueller did than that?
Mueller was operating within what I think we see in the most recent iteration is a broken system for assuring presidential accountability under the law. Let's take the special counsel regulations from the top. Paul's view was this was a public interest matter, yet under those regulations, a very specific decision was made with the acquiescence of Congress that the special counsel was to essentially stick to his criminal law knitting and not, for example, express judgments that were essentially impeachment related judgments. And it was not even to report publicly anything. It was to report only to the attorney general on a confidential basis. The second point, and here I would be critical of Mueller, but I think this is at the bottom, again, sources back to a problem with the system. The OLC opinions immunizing the president from criminal liability while in office have caused no end of trouble. In this case, and this we can talk about also when we get to Bob Barr's version of what Mueller said. In this case, Mueller says that he is, on the basis of that opinion, very reluctant to express a judgment about the president's criminal conduct if the president cannot be tried and cannot defend himself in public. And that is a direct result of his coming up against what he thinks are the constitutional issues, and I happen to think they're bogus, in the two OLC opinions on this point. And I think he got boxed in by that. And I'm not quite sure the execution, how he addressed that, was particularly deft. And the last point I want to make is this, and this is sort of, I think, where the OLC opinion got him, or sort of the cul-de-sac in which it landed him. I think there was both this set of constitutional prudential considerations, and then he left it very muddy. Was that really what the problem was, or was it really a jump ball on the question of prosecutorial judgment here? And he left you with the impression that he's arguing both, that he really can't reach a judgment here because it's inconsistent with his responsibilities given the OLC opinion. Yet he also leaves you with the impression that it's a somewhat mixed factual picture and the decision could have been exercised both ways. And yet after all that, he says, but if I did not believe that the president had committed a crime of obstruction, I would have clearly said so. It's a very muddled record.
Yeah, I actually think it was more than a reluctance to reach the an actual prosecutorial recommendation, because he seems pretty clearly to say, given his role as an attorney in the Department of Justice and under the framework of the special counsel regulations, which, of course, require him to submit what is a traditional prosecution memo that either recommends or a prosecution or recommends a declination of prosecution, that he felt, and he says, this office accepted OLC's legal conclusion for the purpose of exercising prosecutorial jurisdiction. So I read that as, I can't reach the ultimate conclusion of whether a crime was committed because I am bound by this OLC opinion, which, although technically, of course, only implies to the actual indictment, everything within it, and obviously we can criticize it as you have, Bob, would lead to the conclusion that he also couldn't make that recommendation, although he clearly invokes some prudential reasons for that. I think that everything else you see about this report suggests very much that, I mean, he dispenses with the statutory defenses. He dispenses with the constitutional defenses. He analyzes for every one of the 11 episodes how the three prongs of the three elements of obstruction would apply: obstructive act, nexus to an official proceeding or pending or anticipated, and corrupt intent. And he does, to me, he does every single thing except say for each one of those episodes, therefore, I recommend charging on this crime for this crime. So, you know, and I actually still can't say I've read every single word of every single factual scenario that he recounts. But the very fact that he even applied the three elements, you know, an analysis of the three elements to the facts, shows me he went, you know, like 9.9 steps the way and just not that last tenth.
I mean, the other thing that, you know, he offers 10 different examples of potential obstructive conduct. And on some of those, he does offer mixed fact and mixed law, right? Is firing Comey, is that within the Article 2? That's maybe a difficult question. On his public sort of witness intimidation of Michael Cohen, can public, resolving that public comments, it's unusual, but it's not impossible. But then there are other elements in which, Mueller goes through, he articulates this meeting of all of the statutory elements. He refutes any defense, and then he doesn't say anything else. So, yes, there's mixed questions of facts and law on some of the elements, but it's pretty clear Trump's efforts to get Jeff Sessions to unrecuse himself was not within – that's not a legitimate Article 2 function. None of the defenses were sort of relevant to that point. His efforts to get Don McGahn to lie about whether or not he had instructed McGahn to instruct Sessions to fire Mueller, that's not within the Article 2 sort of function. That doesn't raise difficult questions of law and fact. So it's clear that, yes, for some buckets here, there's a close call, but there are at least two or three of these in which, at least taking Mueller's report on its face, he offers an articulation of the meeting of every statutory element, and he doesn't offer any suggestion that he believes the facts or the law are complicated on the question.
All right, so I want to defend Bob Mueller against this onslaught of attacks from Paul, from Charlie, and the depersonalization and institutionalization of it from Bob. First of all, I agree with Mary that this is, I don't think he, looking at the text of this, he presents this as a prudential judgment. I think he presents it as a point of principle. Number one, he is bound by the OLC opinion. Number two, given that he is bound by the OLC opinion and can't issue an indictment, it is inappropriate to make a judgment as to whether he would issue an indictment if he was free to do so. And if you're not going to indict somebody, you have no business, as a general matter, commenting on whether they committed crimes. Number two, I think we need to talk about the Jaworski roadmap here, because in page 1 and 2 of the introduction to the document, he makes clear that one of the prudential factors that he is considering is deference to the congressional process by which, under that OLC opinion, we're supposed to be evaluating presidential misconduct. Now, Bill Barr at his press conference yesterday said that he didn't think Mueller was deferring to Congress, and he certainly hoped he wasn't, because the executive branch has its own functions and shouldn't be doing Congress's work for it. But if you look at what Bob Mueller says Bob Mueller was doing, there is a substantial element of deference to Congress. And so I think the best way to understand what Bob Mueller said here is, I am not able to indict the president. Therefore, I am not going to go through an exercise in which I do a sort of shadow indictment that makes the accusation in a form that I actually have no authority to make. Number three, I am going to do a full investigation. So if when he's out of office, somebody else wants to indict him, that option is available. And along the way, I'm going to create a detailed factual record so that Congress can do its job. And I don't know that I think I certainly think there is a plausible set of arguments that that's a pretty good way to thread this particular needle. And a number of months ago, when we were all sitting around here thinking, how should Bob Mueller play this? You know, I said, gosh, you know, there's this Jaworski roadmap, and here's how he did it. And I bet this is kind of got to be on Bob Mueller's mind at this point. And that's sort of what animated me to try to, you know, go into court and get that document. And I think there's a lot of that in the actual disposition of it. And I want to say I think there's something to it, to be honest.
I mean, I do think that one thing that is clear here is that this was all exacerbated, or the negative features of this were all exacerbated by Barr's intervention. And Barr
great transition, because I was just going to say we need to talk about Bill Barr.
Right, and Barr inserting his gloss. And so, Charlie, I sort of kick this question to you. You know, you had a really great piece in the New York Times this morning that's really just laying out side by side, you know, Barr's presentation versus what Mueller's sort of document said and what those sentences said in context. To my mind, I'm comfortable saying I think Bill Barr lied. I don't know that if he was under oath, you could convict him on perjury, kind of a lie, but a lie in every other sense of the term. And so I'm curious, from your perspective, having kind of done the exercise, am I being unfair to Bill Barr to think that?
So I certainly would not say that this rises to the level of Bill Barr lying. I think that, you know, much of what he said was literally true. And what was interesting, what you're referring to is at the suggestion of Paul here, sitting next to me actually yesterday, I took every quoted passage from the famous Barr letter to Congress last month, in which he drew on an excerpt from the a fragmentary excerpt from the then still secret Mueller report, and to bolster his portrayal of the bottom line findings of the Mueller investigation in that four-page letter to Congress. I took those sentences, none of them, your listeners may recall, were complete sentences, and none of them disclosed the context in which those phrases had come from. And I found in the report the actual paragraphs and sort of put them side by side. And what arises from that exercise is a pattern, and the pattern is that the words were omitted by Mr. Barr, or the context was omitted that really took the meaning of what Mueller was doing and twisted it in a misleading way. And so, for example, he has a sentence fragment about how the special counsel did not find evidence of a criminal conspiracy or a coordination with Congress, with Russia and the Trump campaign. And he uses that to say, well, there was no crime here that Trump was trying to cover up. Therefore, we can infer that his intent was not corrupt. And that's part of why I, Bill Barr, am proclaiming that Trump is cleared of obstruction of justice. And when you looked at that phrase about no, did not establish a coordination between the campaign and Russia, it's embedded in a paragraph in which Mueller is explaining that while the evidence he found did not rise to meet, you know, proving beyond a reasonable doubt that there was that, there's all kinds of other reasons why Trump may have had a motive to obstruct justice, like covering up personal embarrassment or the notion that his election was illegitimate, or that there may have been some other crimes committed. And so to use that phrase as showing that there was no intention, could have been no intention for obstruction when it came from a place which was all about how nevertheless there were lots of potential motives for obstruction, is really turning what Mueller was doing on its head. And there are many other examples of that, and I won't laboriously march through, but basically every single one of these, you look at it in context and you're like, wow, that's not really what Mueller was doing or saying or trying to convey there. And these words Barr was using, he was putting them toward his own purpose in crafting this quite interesting and now questionable letter to Congress. But all that said, and it raises questions about Barr's wisdom, because he knew he was going to put this report out in a few weeks and that surely people were going to compare the quotes he was using in March to the actual report, and that his credibility would then come under scrutiny. So I don't know what to make of that. All that said, I still would not, I think myself, say that it rises to the level of lying.
Okay, so I want to talk about Bill Barr. And specifically, I want to start by asking whether anybody, either remotely or in the studio, will say anything in defense of his press conference yesterday.
Not a word. And actually, I woke up yesterday morning prepared to give Bill Barr the benefit of the doubt. I actually think, in terms of redactions, he appeared to have comported himself reasonably. And after that press conference, I am instinctively suspicious and skeptical, not just of his future decisions, but am rethinking my prior analysis of his past decisions, because it was such an aberration, so inappropriate, so contrary to the values of the Department of Justice. It really alters my perception.
Mary, you are the person sitting across from me who most represents the values of the department. What'd you make of it? Is there anything to be said in defense of it?
Well, I thought what was really striking about it is that particularly when he got ready to introduce the subject of the obstruction part of the report, that he prefaced that with really what I can only say a personal defense lawyer would preface any kind of press conference on, which is that as Trump came into office, he was angry and frustrated that reporting about the Russian interference might undermine the legitimacy of his election. And he tried to paint this picture that anger and frustration might have been sort of, you know, what led him to maybe say some things occasionally that he shouldn't have said, but that there was really nothing more to see here. And when the Department of Justice, first of all, it's unusual to do a press conference in a situation where you're not either announcing, you know, some sort of new initiative or announcing an indictment. So here we're doing a press conference to announce a report that ends up, you know, not recommending an indictment. So it's already a strange posture. But then to come in and sort of try to explain even more why, color even more the narrative about what people are about to see an hour later and be able to read for themselves, I thought was extraordinary. And I think the point, you know, when we just back to Susan's point of whether Barr lied or not, moving away from the March letter to Congress, his answer to the question about whether the reason Mueller declined to make a finding of whether the president committed a crime of obstruction, whether that reason was based on the OLC memo, that came about as close to a lie, if not a lie, as you could get, because Barr, knowing what's in the report, nevertheless said that when he spoke to Mueller, Mueller said it was not, he was not saying that but for the OLC opinion, he would have found a crime. And he made it clear he had not made the determination there was a crime. When you read the report, it seems abundantly clear, as we've just discussed, that at least the reason he didn't reach a conclusion was because of the OLC report.
Bob, Paul,
do
either of you have anything to say in defense of the press conference?
I can say something which I wouldn't characterize as a defense of Barr. I thought, for example, his testimony on the spying point this last week in the middle of all of this was very ill-advised. But I have a somewhat different take. And that is, I think that Barr is not so much in this to defend Trump as he is in it to defend a view, which I happen to disagree with, about executive branch prerogatives and immunities. I don't suppose he cares whether Donald Trump disappears and he never sees him again, but this is a consistent view he's taken. It motivated him to put the famous memo to the administration when he was not yet in office and under consideration for AG. I think he anticipated a strong spin. He's a hardcore Republican, a strong spin on the Democratic side. So he decided to give an advanced counter spin to neutralize it. And I also believe, and this I can't prove, that a lot of the anger at Barr is safer for people who are very angry or disappointed or frustrated with Mueller.
That's interesting. Charlie?
You wanted some word of defense in the press conference, and I thought that one thing that Barr said, which we haven't talked about yet, was quite interesting, and you can't actually see it very well, what I'm about to say, in the report, because it's so, this section is so heavily redacted, but it's important and insightful, which was he addressed the question, or maybe he preemptively raised it, not about indicting or not indicting the campaign, not for collusion conspiracy with Russia, but for conspiracy with WikiLeaks. And there's a lot of redacted before a grand jury and ongoing matter material in the report about the campaign's outreach to WikiLeaks. Obviously, there's the whole Jerome Corsi, Roger Stone, et cetera, stuff that is still unresolved. And Barr explained that there's no – WikiLeaks broke no law by publishing the stolen Democratic emails if it did not participate in the crime of the underlying hacking. And no one – has accused WikiLeaks and Assange of helping the Russian government hack the Democratic email servers. No one thinks that their skills would have been required. The Russians could do that on their own and did that before they had reached out to WikiLeaks, unlike, say, the recent indictment of Assange for purportedly agreeing to help Chelsea Manning try to break into a defense classified network under a different username than her own. There was no participation in the underlying illegal conduct from which these files came to be exfiltrated from their rightful owners. And so all kinds of collusion and conspiracy in the non-legal sense between the campaign and WikiLeaks would still not amount to an indictable offense because you can't conspire to not break the law. And I think that's very important and has gotten less attention than it should have, maybe in part because of the redactions in the report that covered up that material. It also, and part of the reasons I think it's important and I consider it praiseworthy is because it shows that the Barr Justice Department is continuing the traditional understanding that publishing information, that one should be reluctant to try to make publishing information a crime. As a journalist, obviously, I have a vested interest in that norm being respected and not having the Justice Department try to show that publishing information can be a crime under some circumstances. And also there's been some bad takes out there for that this refutes. For example, Andy McCarthy in the National Review wrote this long piece after the Assange indictment saying, well, why wasn't Assange indicted for collusion with the Russians? This shows that the deep state just is afraid to put on trial the evidence that Russia was involved in the hacking of the Democratic emails. And the Barr explanation that they broke no law if they merely received and published that information convincingly shows why that was a dumb thing to build a column around in the National Review.
So just one other thought on the conference, and it's neither in support of nor in condemnation, but a remarkable gap that is explained by its timing, which is I think that the one thing that Barr really does have to answer for that he hasn't been asked yet is his independent judgment to exonerate the president on obstruction of justice. We've just spent a huge amount of time debating whether or not Mueller should have reached a judgment, and the premise of that discussion was the belief amongst, I think, everybody who was talking about it, even you, that had he reached such a judgment, Mueller's judgment would have been that the president committed indictable acts, and it's just because of the prohibition that he wasn't indicted and that he committed impeachable acts as well, and acts for which he might face judgment post-presidency. So what is most puzzling to me out of the Barr gloss on the Mueller report, and it wasn't addressed in the press conference because we didn't know it was coming because we hadn't seen the report yet, is what is the ground on which Barr reached a contrary prosecutorial conclusion against what seems to be such the great weight of evidence supporting the affirmative value of a prosecution, even if Mueller didn't want to say it? So that's a big gap, and I want to know.
Although, Paul, it's kind of odd for you to both criticize Mueller for not making a judgment as the essential task of a prosecutor and criticize Barr for then turning around and making the judgment.
But I don't think he's saying Barr has not explained how exactly this set of facts allows him to reach a judgment that no crime was committed.
Yeah, and why he disagreed with Mueller's determination that this circumstance precludes prosecutorial judgment because of the unique nature of the presidency.
Gotcha. All right. So I wanna wrap up with one additional question before we sort of do final thoughts. Susan mentioned earlier that she thought the actual redactions of the document were pretty creditable and that they weren't overly dramatic, didn't appear to have a particular political valence to them. I look at them and I say most of them are quite minor. The ones that's doing all the work in terms of actual redaction space is Pending Matters, and that's presumably deals with evidence in the Roger Stone case that's going to come out, and there's very little grand jury information. And by the way, all the other redactions, Congress will be able to see the entire thing. So I am left being pretty unworried on the redaction front. And I'm wondering if any of you think that there is this is a remaining major concern, and specifically, you know, the Democratic House Judiciary Committee today subpoenaed the entire document. They seem to be trying to go after the entire document. Is that the right fight for them to be having? Mary?
So I think that if there had been more 6E material redacted, I expected that kind of fight, especially because there is an exception in 6E, at least with respect to national security, foreign intelligence information, and that the House might try to say that, you know, that exception would apply to that type of material. That would be different from obstruction, of course. So I don't see anything about these redactions that strikes me as anyone taking an overly broad or unreasonable position on the redactions. I'm a little worried about, frankly, the subpoena to see the entire report when it includes seeing everything that relates to ongoing matters, because for similar reasons that the Department of Justice doesn't share, you know, details of ongoing investigations with the White House, it also doesn't share details of ongoing criminal investigations with Congress. And there are some exceptions for national security investigations where Congress, particularly the intelligence committees, need to know some of the intelligence information to perform their job. But if it's otherwise really all information about an ongoing criminal case that doesn't have those same sort of intelligence components, I do think that the department needs to be careful. And maybe some of this is stuff that it does appear mostly in the part one of the report, which has to do with the Russian election interference. But I do think that it's worth holding a line at not opening criminal prosecutorial and investigative files to Congress, without good reason.
Okay, so we got to wrap up, but does anybody fundamentally disagree with that and think that the redactions are a big problem that we need to that is worth big fight over?
So I think there is one category. I largely agree with that. I think there is one set of redactions that I do have suspicions about, and that is that redacted under the category of harmful to ongoing materials appears to be conversations that would go to Donald Trump's personal individual knowledge of the Russian efforts, essentially. So paragraphs that start with Michael Cohen is in Donald Trump's office. Big redaction, final clause. Rick Gates and Donald Trump are driving to the car. There starts to be a discussion. Big redaction. last line says Donald Trump says okay. That's relevant and important for us to know, and I'm suspicious of the motivation behind it. But ultimately, fighting over these redactions is a way of stalling the big question that Congress does not want to confront, even the Democrats in the House, which is the question of whether or not they need to move to impeachment inquiries.
Bob, final thoughts. What happens next?
Of course, there's going to be the testimony of Barr. There's going to be the testimony of Mueller. This is going to continue to be an issue. There may, in fact, be some reporting about what took place within the Mueller team and so forth. I do think long term, there is a fundamental breakdown like the one that was detected after Watergate that led to the independent counsel statute in the system of accountability for presidential misconduct. It has influenced all of the actors in this process. The answer was thought to lie in the current arrangement with the special counsel regulations. This episode reveals that that isn't working either.
Charlie.
No parting thoughts, but thanks for letting me participate as a guest lawfarer today.
Thanks, Charlie. You're an honorary lawfarer under all circumstances. Paul.
It's a really shockingly depressing report. I mean, even if you leave out everything about President Trump that we've been talking about, the idea that Russia could, with such a really high degree of success, disrupt the fundamental structure of the American electoral process and to this moment suffer no serious adverse consequences, you know, gets at the foundations of the idea of American democracy. And, you know, Donald Trump will pass from this scene at some point, sooner or later. Whether or not the American democratic process can survive the assault of authoritarians in this era of social media is an open question and really disturbing to me.
Susan.
I agree it is a shocking document. It describes shocking conduct on behalf of the president. I am unsettled to see the responses from both sides of Congress, which is Republicans circling the wagon and saying essentially, you know, they're not going to do anything to hold the president of their own party accountable. I'm also unsettled to see the response on the Democrat side, which seemed to be reducing the question of how to proceed to pure political judgments. What's going to serve them better in the presidential election? Impeachment is an independent constitutional obligation, and I think they have a real duty to consider the question seriously.
Mary?
Just one sort of geek out legal point here. You know, Bill Barr a year ago sent an unsolicited 19-page memo of his legal view of obstruction, both under the statute and under the Constitution. That was really torn to bits in this report. And I know Michael Dreeben, who's argued more than 100 cases in the Supreme Court as the Deputy Solicitor General, criminal cases. I'm guessing he wrote that section, and I'd put him up against Bill Barr any day.
And here's my final thought. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare Podcast. You know, the Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, whether it's a special edition, a regular edition, an emergency podcast, or something else. You should, especially on special editions, share the Lawfare Podcast on social media, tweet about it, share us on Facebook. You know, throw dinner parties and talk endlessly to your guests about the Lawfare Podcast. You can buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com, and you should. Our audio engineer today is Michaela Fogel, the long-suffering Michaela Fogel, who now has to edit this audio file. There's no music on special editions of the Lawfare Podcast, but damn it, if there were, it would be performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.